On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Sometimes you have to step way back to see what's going on in the world. For centuries, the view from the moon looked something like this. The West on a roll, confident and expansive. Once proud Islam in retreat, Asia out of it. Today, says my guest this hour, it's a whole new map out there. The West in a culture of fear. Islam a culture of humiliation. And Asia, the planet's new culture of hope. Shifts like this are rare and profound. Their effects can last hundreds of years. Joining me today from Paris is Dominique Moisy. He's a big European intellectual and geostrategist, founder and senior advisor at the French Institute of International Affairs. The New York Times' Tom Friedman calls him one of France's top foreign policy analysts. His essay in the current issue of Foreign Affairs is The Clash of Emotions, Fear, Humiliation, Hope, and the New World Order. Dominique Moisy, thanks so much for being with us from Paris.
Thank you for inviting me.
Please share your thesis with us. The roles are shifting. The outlooks are changing. How do you see that happening?
Well, I'm very struck whenever I travel between Europe, the United States, Asia, and the Middle East by extremely different moods. And what strikes me most, maybe because I'm French, is the culture of fear that has developed in my country, but I believe beyond my country in Europe. And I find elements of that culture of fear when I arrive in the United States. And the moment I am in Asia, I'm caught by contrast with the dynamism and the culture of hope that is present in China, in India, in smaller countries such as Singapore. There is a feel-good factor in the majority of people I meet in Asia, and there is a fearful factor in the majority of people I meet in the West.
Dominique Moisy, we'll look at what's going on, that contrast today, but I wish you'd just contrast that for us for a moment with the pattern of history in the last several centuries. If you could, describe for us, if this is correct, what a shift this is.
Yes, I think it is a big shift. But you have to have in mind that China was, in the 18th century, a very self-confident empire. There was last year a major exhibit at the Royal Academy of Arts in London called The Three Emperors, and the key painting was an 18th century big reproduction of the envoys of Europe paying tribute to the Chinese emperor. And the message of that exhibit, which was sponsored by the Chinese government, was very explicit, and it was China is back. And seen from China, it is not so much a shift than a renaissance of China. They used to be a great power, and they feel they are returning to be.
So granted, China has a history that leaves it very comfortable with the idea of being the Middle Kingdom, kind of the center of the universe. But it's 300 years since that century, and those years have been full of images of the West on a roll, bold, on the march, sailing ships going everywhere, colonies, the Western ideology and values and religion being ascendant all over the place. That sounds like a vast retreat from that forward march of the West to what you describe as a posture now of fear. What's propelled that?
Well, a lot of historical shift. I mean, one could say that Europe did not survive as a power the two world wars, 1914, 1918, 1939, 1935, which are seen by many historians as one big civil European war. And it may be said that the American century was shorter than people would expect it to be. It started in 1941 with Pearl Harbor and the entrance of America as clearly the number one indisputable power in the world. And it may be ending in front of our eyes right now. And it may be that a combination of not 9/11, but the American answer to 9/11 and the Iraqi disaster have accelerated that shift in history.
You've got so much on the table here. We want to look at it. What the hopeful Asia, the ideas of Asia carrying the torch for hope is kind of still a striking one today. But first, to look at this fear in the West, I wish you'd begin with Europe. You say that Europe's fears are of many layers now. Take us through some of those, if you would.
Yes, I tend to describe them as archaeological layers of fear. You have the fear of being invaded by the poorest, coming mainly from the African continent. You have the fear from being blown up by the most fanatics, coming from Islamic fundamentalism. The fear to be left behind by the most dynamics. And that is clearly today essentially Asia.
Left behind economically.
Economically, absolutely. But then there is the fear not to be any longer in control of your own life, either because you are governed by a bureaucratic, anonymous power, Brussels, or a benevolent superpower, the United States. But by the end of the day, it's the fear that you are no longer in control of your present and that your future might be less good than your past was.
Now, we've seen that described as the outlook of Europe, and we know that there are polls in the U.S. that express similar apprehension among Americans about whether or not their children will be better off than them. On the other hand, do we really share a common profile of fear in the United States and Europe? Or is it different? You write yourself. You say Europeans try to protect themselves through a combination of escapism and appeasement. Americans try to do so by dealing with the problem at its source abroad. That latter doesn't sound so fearful, or is it?
Well, it's clear that there are major differences between Europe and the United States in terms of means. America is much more powerful than Europe is. In terms of outlook also, there is still in American society, a sense of dynamism, flexibility. In fact, I was struck returning from Asia how much the soft power of America still functioned in countries like India, of course, but also China. But beyond that, I sense in the discourses of the American administration, but also in the mentality of the American people, something that sounds like what we are witnessing in Europe. It's not of the same intensity, it does not translate in the same manner, but it's there. It's the feeling that, well, you've lost some sense of optimism vis-à-vis the future, if not individually, at least collectively as a nation. It is also the fact that you are no longer in control of yourself, of your body. Obesity has become such a huge problem in America. Of your budget, look at the huge deficit of the United States. What are you going to leave to your children, but also, above all, the world? Are you in control of the world?
And in between these two and this role reversal that you're describing, Islam, which you describe as a culture of humiliation, the other two, I see the shift. Humiliation seems as though it's been a kind of steady state for Islam since, Vienna in 1683, since the Ottoman Empire fell in World War I. Is this culture of humiliation something new in between here or not?
I don't think it's something new. I think it has been there, and I describe in my piece the shift taking place in the Renaissance, what we call the Renaissance in Europe, is the beginning of decline for Islam. When we were in the Middle Age, Islam was in full Renaissance, at least in its Spanish Islamic part. But I sense an aggravation of that humiliation, which is in part due to history, to a large extent, the symbol of an Islam no longer in control of its destiny has been the creation of the State of Israel, perceived by the Arab world as the ultimate insult, the ultimate proof that they were no longer in control. But also the process of globalization. I mean, globalization means transparency. Globalization means permanent benchmarking. You can see the way others live. You can see the way others are succeeding. And in the Arab Islamic world, success exists, but it is more of an homeopathic nature. You see it in the United Arab Emirates. You see it in Dubai. You see it, but you don't see it in Egypt. You don't see it in the big populated areas. Mm-hmm.
Jeff is calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air with Dominique Moisy.
Hi, how are you?
Well, what do you think?
Hi. I just wanted to point out, I wanted to ask your guest, if he could name another country that, you know, sends out more aid to other countries than us. If there is another country that has a more advanced Navy, Army, and Air Force than we do. If there's another country that has a more influential economy on the rest of the world. And if there's another country that is seen as more powerful than we are, I think he's, sorry to say, I just think you're pushing an agenda, and I think it's people like you that speak to America being weakened. You're just trying to push some kind of agenda.
Jeff, we'll put that exactly to Dominique Moisy, but let me ask you, what about his thesis behind the individual pieces you lay out there? Do you flat out disagree with him that the U.S. is motivated by fear more than hope these days?
No, I think that I think people aren't involved with the government enough. I think a lot of people are driven by fear, and that's why a lot of new policies are coming out, which could destroy this country in the future, like global, with blanket amnesty and things like that, and the Patriot Act and the revisions and stuff like that. But it's not something that's going to destroy this country. We just need people to wake up.
Jeff, we've got it. Dominique Moisy, there's American pushback, the kind of pushback Europeans get frequently in this country today. Jeff says, come on, who's more powerful than the United States? And you, our dear European friend, are pushing a political agenda.
let's start with the specific. When Jeff says that America is the largest donor in the world of aid, it's not in relation to its wealth or its size. Proportionally, America is not number one at that level. On other issues, I do agree. America is by far the most powerful country when it comes to strategy, to military. It has still, by far, the largest economy, though that economy is growing at a much less rapid speed than the big Asian's economy. Mm. But at the same time, what I'm saying is that power, as defined as hard power, the power to constrain, has met extremely serious limits. And my deep belief is that America yesterday was uniquely powerful because she combined soft power, the power to convince by imitation, the power to seduce, and hard power, and an abuse and inefficient use of hard power has dramatically reduced the soft power of America in the world globally, with the exception of those Asian countries that are doing well and that still see in American society a model, because they care less about America as a power than, let's say, Europeans, or for that matter, most countries in the world.
And you're right, they may care less about traditional American values. But let me ask you something that Jeff surfaces directly there. I mean, you write yourself that this culture of fear, as you see it, on the West umbrella style, is dividing rather than uniting the United
yes.
States and Europe. Why that? What's the example of that? And why that dynamic instead of fear uniting yeah. the West?
Yeah, I think that's one of the points which I found the most important and disturbing in writing that essay for Foreign Affairs. I saw the culture of humiliation, unfortunately, rejoining the world, uniting the world of Islam, whereas the culture of fear was largely dividing the West. There was divisions about the best ways to fight terrorism, and there were, of course, many Europeans believing that American answers to 9/11 was not a solution to the problem, but part of the problem. And there is, of course, the sense of not taking Europe seriously, which is very present in Washington, a kind of poo-pooing of those weak, coward Europeans, which you cannot take seriously. So, yes, I saw that after 9/11, in spite of the common emotions that followed immediately the tragedy, there were elements of divisions which, of course, exploded as a result of the war in Iraq.
But why fundamentally should that be? The West has enjoyed an awful lot of a profit and advantage and glory and you name it in a kind of more or less united cultural stand for a long time now. You know, behind these events, what is it in the postures of the U.S. and the Europe that would push them apart rather than rally them together in a moment of vulnerability?
Well, I think I would tend to emphasize two factors: the nature of the Bush administration and the crisis of confidence in the European Union. I have been an American watcher and an American admirer for all of my life, since I was a student at Harvard University more than 30 years ago. And I never felt myself so alienated from the American administration than with this one. The sense of ideology, a sense of self-righteousness, to the point of completely ignoring reality or emotion of others. And this most ideological U.S. administration has encountered the most diffident, the most pessimistic Europe that you could find.
A Europe of escapism and appeasement, as you describe
it. And that's that combination which has been historically catastrophic. A more confident Europe would have been more balanced vis-à-vis the Bush administration. And it is probable that the Bush administration might have been slightly more reserved with a more self-confident Europe.
Mm. And with all that, Dominique Moisy sees hope shifting away, shifting to Asia. Jason's calling from Marlboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say the gentleman is absolutely right. I'm a truck driver. I listen to talk radio all across the country, local and national.
Yeah.
And it just breaks my heart that the just the America's reaction to 9/11, I mean, that was from a terrorist organization, and it has just torn this country apart, more so than what even, I suppose, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda could possibly have imagined.
But do you really think America is now a part of a fearful culture rather than a bold culture?
Oh, absolutely, sir. Even more so, it's become a culture of hate towards other Americans. I mean, if you listen to Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly...
we know the stripes, yeah.
Yeah, they just preach hatred towards their fellow Americans, and it's just terrible that this has all come to this, you know?
Mm. Jason, thanks for the observation, and thanks for the call. Dominique Moisy, let me ask you, in your view, is emotion or outlook, is it destiny? If a region becomes more hopeful, does their future become more hopeful? If they become fearful, does their future become darker? Is outlook destiny?
Well, I think it plays a big role. I think there is a feel-good factor in Asia, which is very important in the success of the continent. A feeling that, well, today is better than yesterday and that tomorrow will be even better than today. It encourages you to work hard. It encourages you to make sacrifices for the future. And in a way, what strikes me is that in Europe, we are managing our past, while in Asia, a lot of people are inventing their future. And that is a very different mental attitude.
We're going to hear in just a moment from Orville Schell, longtime China watcher, to get to go deeper on what a continent, a culture of hope in Asia may bring. Let me get another caller here first, though. Columbia, South Carolina. William is on the line. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How are you? I just wanted to see if I could elicit a comment. I think it's necessary to point out that, in fact, there are tremendous fears within China rooted in social tensions, class conflict, the magnitude of which far overshadow anything you would encounter in the United States, let alone in Europe. That's one dimension of fear that exists in Asia.
Yep.
And another dimension, which I think is even more important, particularly from the geopolitical standpoint, if you're trying to factor this all into a global view, as it were, is the fact that there's tremendous fear rooted in racism and nationalism. The intensity of the rivalries between China and its immediate neighbors, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, it, again, far overshadows anything you would encounter in the United States and Europe. And I think both of these fears, the social tensions within China and nationalist racist rivalries within Europe, make it necessary to assert that it's far from certain how Asia will work out in the future as globalization, modernization progresses.
Right, we've got it. So no rose garden in Asia. With all that, and you're clearly watching closely, what about the big observation? Dominique Moisey sees a greater culture of hope there now than here. With all those problems, do you agree with him on that or not?
But that's directed to me?
Yes, sir.
Again, I think there's much more uncertainty in Asia than one might believe just listening. I realize he provides a more sophisticated analysis than one might think just listening to his gloss on the issue. China, I know this from personal experience, has no functioning social welfare system. They're beginning to create it. But the magnitude of fear, raw fear, existential fear, class conflict, social tension, within China is absolutely tremendous.
William, let's pick it up, and I appreciate your call very much. Dominique Moisey, what do you say? You've pointed out Asia is not without its own internal problems, some very substantial. William says, no kidding, a culture of hope in spite of that? Is that naivete, or are you oversimplifying Asia's future scenario outlook?
No, I think the points William made are very legitimate, but I would not call them elements of fears, but elements of risks. There are risks stemming from the presence of unsolved nationalistic issues. I mean, Asia is like Europe in 1950. There are still nationalistic tensions between China and Japan, the way they were between France and Germany 5 years after World War II. There are incredible social tensions. But by the end of the day, I make the assumption that though those risks are extremely present, there is something in the feel-good factor, the sense of progress of the Chinese. There is something in the sense of historical confidence of the country, in the calendar of the leaders of China, that will probably prevent the worst to occur. I mean, the Chinese are very patient. They have the feeling that they are returning to the role they used to play. They are not nouveau riche of power, like, let's say, Germany at the end of the 19th century under Wilhelm II. They have time, and their priority is not to impress their power on others, but to become stronger and stronger economically. They know this is the key to the survival of the regime. And their emphasis on geoeconomics, by contrast with sheer geopolitics, is probably for us a source of optimism.
I want to bring another view in here, if I may. Dominique Mozy, please stand by in Paris. Joining us from Berkeley, California, is Orville Schell, longtime China watcher, dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, author of Mandate of Heaven, The Legacy of Tiananmen Square, and The Next Generation of China's Leaders. Orville Schell, thank you very much for being with us today.
A pleasure to be with you.
So you have read, you know Dominique Mozy's thesis, Culture of Hope, Rising in Asia. I'll ask at some point, well, do you agree? But more importantly, at this point in the conversation, what does that mean? Do you see Asia taking the lead as the center of hope, dynamism, progress? And in what direction would that progress be? Where does Asian hope lead the world?
Well, I think Dominique has written a really wonderful, very interesting piece that sort of gives us a different geography, a different sort of way to describe the geography of the world, not in terms of culture or economics, but really in terms of sort of the psychological temperatures of these places. You know, as to, I mean, obviously China is a country that I've spent a lot of time in and thinking about. There is undeniably a sense of optimism and a new sense of confidence in China, and this is all the more apparent because it's sort of growing on top of, you know, over a century and a half of real victim culture. Now, I wouldn't say victim culture in China has completely subsided or completely been sort of resolved, but there is something that Dominique, I think, points out that is absolutely true. But I think that it's also worth bearing in mind that when you take the sort of emotional temperatures of each country or culture, that there is something extraordinarily distorting about the whole mutant phenomenon of the Bush administration that tends to, I think, make us have a very unrealistic assessment of other cultures, other economies, and other worlds because we ourselves feel so out of sorts.
We're talking this hour about the new map of global outlooks, global emotions. Dominique Mozy joins us from Paris. Orville Schell joins us from Berkeley, California. I want to come back to Orville Schell, but let me get a caller in first, if I may. Richard from Arnold, Maryland. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I completely agree with what Mr. Mozy is saying. I think that's what the 2006 elections were about. When we see the basically rejected most of the far right, their fear-based things and their whole policies, this whole thing that's going to happen tomorrow, another surge, the let's win, that's fear. I see what's happening is with particularly the rise of the popular Senator Barack Obama. He presents a message of hope for the future. It's based on spiritual values, and he wants to use what you call, what Mr. Mozy calls, the soft power. We've rejected the military economic hard power. I think America, basically, myself and others, there's a lot of optimism still here. We've lost it, and I think the 2006 elections was a signal that we're trying to go back to it.
So, Richard, you're painting it then the last few years, perhaps, of fear as an aberration. You're saying it's just kind of out of sync with the real American view, and we'll snap back to hope?
Absolutely. Americans are basically very optimistic people. We've just allowed some very far-right wingers to project fear of Islam, fear of God knows what. We are still basically, I think, an optimistic people.
Richard, let me pick it up right there. Orville Schell, how about it? Is that the point you're making? You're saying this is just a moment where we sort of lost our balance and the country will be back in the hopeful category soon? Are you as confident as Richard of that?
Well, I think we have some real problems, but I do think we have a tendency, we've seen this in future, in past bubbles, to project our worst fears and that others will somehow transcend us and supersede us. We did this with Japan, we did it with the Five Dragons, and now it's China's turn. So I think that's worth bearing in mind, that there's something of a failure of nerve, which isn't surprising. We're stuck in Iraq. We have a president who seems incapable of leading, and the world is losing trust and hope in America as being a leading power. So all of this stuff, I think, reverberates back on us, and it allows countries like China, which is on something of a tear, but as one of your callers pointed out, is one of the, I think, is the most unresolved country of consequence in the world today, to sort of puff itself up a bit and believe in itself, which is good. But I would have to say that the problems that China has to confront put Europe and the United States, our problems, pale by comparison. So this confidence and this optimism could be, is very fragile.
Dominic Moisy, how does this few minutes of American conversation sound to your French ears? The notion that, no, this is not a new era of fear, this is a moment of fear, and it may already be passing.
Well, I hope it's true. I hope there will be, in Europe and more globally in the West, the return of a culture of hope, that it will be demonstrated by the result of the next American elections and other elections in Europe. But what I'm trying to allude to in my piece is something that goes beyond the daily evolution of politics. What I'm sensing is, in fact, a shift in the international system. There was a unique unipolar moment of the United States. And that moment lasted from something like 1989 till today. And I fear that the Clinton administration has lost time, and that the Bush administration has taken America in the wrong direction, and that as a combination of that lost time and wrong direction, a new world has emerged, with power being less central than it was, and America not being the only country to be of influence in the world. I mean, America is unique in terms of power, but America is no longer unique in terms of influence. You have, of course, China, but you have also India, and then you have the return as a nuisance value of Russia, influenced essentially on energy. And so we are entering something like an asymmetrical, multipolar world. Something which was supposed to bring stability to the world, according to the French president, but something, I'm afraid, which is bringing, to the contrary, elements of chaos and instability.
Let me ask you, beyond chaos and instability, though, after such a long period of Western hope and Western, in many ways, let's call it for what it's been, Western dominance, if that is changing, in your view, what does the future look like? How does it look different if the cultures of hope are in Asia, if it's China, if it's India? How does the world culture, how does the way the world works change down the road if it stays on the beam that you see it on, Dominic Moisy?
Well, I'll be a terrible Westerner. And I would say that one of the things that worries me most is that in the domination of the West, there was something like the sense of universalism. What we were doing was, of course, for us, but went beyond us. There was a true belief in the values of human rights, democracies. And I think one of the worst thing is that the Americans have damaged the belief in those qualities for themselves and for the rest of the world. And I see in the Chinese new confidence something of a greater cynicism. In fact, they don't care so much about what's happening in the rest of the world. What they want is to regain their status, to regain their influence. And the great victim of this shift is probably the concept of democracy. And the irony of thing is that the big democratization process project of the Bush administration. If you remember, we start by bringing democracy to Baghdad and then we'll enlarge it to the rest of the Middle East, will coincide with the greatest democratic crisis which the West has witnessed, a disbelief in the value of democracy. First, you can succeed without democracy. Second, you don't respect the values you preach yourself.
And China may not have a problem with that. Steve's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and Mr. Shell, Mr. Wazi. Thanks so much. Just a great deal of breakfast here for brains to pry open.
Big meal.
Yeah, indeed. I really appreciate both of the elements that Mr. Shell and Mr. Wazi are offering here, and I've just got a run of ideas here, and then I'm going to give this up to other callers. I think there's a dominance in government that Mr. Shell talks about that leads to a primary distortion for complacent citizens. And the outcome of that is that those powerful, dominant governments take great risk. Out of that great risk, there is always a systematic fear. And I think this is where Mr. Wazi crosses his path quite nicely. With that systematic fear, you can hold your complacent citizenry for quite some time. In our particular case, we have the Grand Republic of America versus them, the terrorists.
Steve, let me ask you, though, hasn't there been an awful lot of risk-taking in the last centuries of Western history that was hope-driven and not fear-driven? I mean, let's find the Northwest Passage. Let's go, you know, find a new passage to India. Let's go to the moon. I mean, that, of course, there was fear that...
I was thinking even further back than that. Let's send a great force to the Middle East to clarify this Middle East problem. Let's have the kings bring together armies, and let's go down there and get this Christian idea in the world so that we can have world peace. We have always been at this difficulty of great risk and systematic fear against terrorism. And I agree with Mr. Wazi. There is a nasty systemic fear that underlies our society right now.
Let's look at the quotients here, Steve. Let us pick that up if we may. Dominique Wazi, what about, Steve says, there's always fear beneath the actions of great powers, fear alongside hope.
That is true. But I have a feeling, I was on the Normandy beaches for the celebration of the 60th anniversary. Mm. And I could compare the souvenir of the veterans and the realities of the soldiers in Iraq. That was a different story. I mean, in Normandy, though you destroyed French cities and killed thousands of French citizens, those who survive, those who are still there, their children, their grandchildren, are still seeing those moments with a huge amount of respect, affection, recognition for what Americans and America did for us. And somewhere the idea that you could apply the same method in a completely different culture, such as the Middle East, was probably a recipe for catastrophe and was the product of largely the fact that the culture of fear had completely overcome the culture of hope that existed in America to obscure the judgment of American leaders.
Orville Schell, when Dominique Wazi describes what the outcome of an Asian rise, Asian hope may be, he's open-minded, but puts it in terms that are disturbing if it sets democracy back. How do you see it? Should the West fear Asian hope or welcome it?
Well, I think he's right on when he speaks about this sort of the trend of it's sort of a trend of mercantile culture over sort of democratic culture, of economics over politics, and that's sort of China's hallmark. That, and I think he's really hit the target when he says that the main thrust of China's sort of intention and energy now is to become strong. I mean, this is a whole theme throughout Chinese history. Fuqiang, there's a whole movement in the last part of the 19th century, the self-strengthening movement. So that's its intention, and it doesn't really involve such squishy topics as humanism and democracy. And I think this whole experiment that the West has been in is now sort of being eclipsed by this new kind of economic realpolitik that doesn't factor things like culture, democracy, rights, sort of the human side of life into things.
But strength doesn't stand alone. Once it reaches a certain scale, it has a character.
It does, but the character of the ingredients that are sort of viewed as elemental in a great nation are somewhat different in the Chinese view of things. I mean, the French are very fond of you know, putting a greater importance on the role of culture or politics or democracy, all these things he mentioned. The Chinese are not. So this gives them a rather a mono diet of economics, 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 and it's quite intimidating. They've been very successful, but they are not. You could say they're not eating a very well balanced meal. So this is why I think it's worth, even though he is right, Dominique is right about this, the cultures of hope and cultures of sort of fear and failure of nerve, which I think characterizes the West. I think you also have to say that the Chinese are on a somewhat unique and perhaps not particularly well-balanced and possibly not even particularly durable experiment, because it is very lopsided.
Though not particularly endurable is a short phrase with potentially kind of horrific implications. I don't know. Dominique Moisy, what about it? Do you see India modulating this? Amartya Sen says, hey, West, don't think you're the only region that can support democracy. And beyond democracy, Orville Schell suggests there's more at stake. What do you see at stake if the West does not regain its hopeful posture?
Well, I think what Orville said is absolutely right and fundamental. But this unbalanced diet of the Chinese needs an element which is fundamental if they are not going to die of their bad diet. And that is not democracy, but that is the rule of law. The introduction of the rule of law, the way it exists in countries like Singapore, is absolutely vital for the long-term survival and success of the Chinese experiment. Let's forget about democracy for a moment. It will take centuries, if ever. But the rule of law is essential. Corruption is a very powerful poison that is destroying the very basis of the system. And we see it at work in countries non-democratic as China, even in democratic countries like India.
Dominique Moisy, with a great big picture dappled there at the end, but a kind of world in major shift notion you've set on the table for us today. We're very grateful for your time from Paris. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for inviting me.
Dominique Moisy, Senior Advisor at the French Institute of International Affairs, and Orville Schell at University of California, Berkeley, author of Mandate of Heaven. Orville Schell, always wonderful speaking with you. Thanks very much for your in today.
Pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.